there in time.
I'm going to formally open the meeting of the Joint Committee on Implementing Measure 91 this President's Day, February 16th. Thank you for being here tonight. We've got a lot of interesting speakers and information to learn. And so let's get started. I think we have a couple more committee members who will be coming in as they get out of their other committees. But at the very beginning, I wanted to note that we have a guest speaker who is a leader of work related to marijuana legalization around the country, as well as important transportation work and strengthening our agricultural sector here in Oregon and a number of other things, and that is Congressman Blumenauer. And it is our great good fortune to welcome him to speak with us for some opening remarks this evening. Congressman, if you're ready, we would love to have you come to the front, and I'll open an informational hearing for this evening on licensing and related issues, with a lead off by Congressman Blumenauer. Opting out taxes.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, distinguished members. I deeply appreciate the opportunity to spend a few minutes with you this afternoon. I'm pleased that the Oregon legislature has responded with a pretty high octane committee focused on the implementation of this legislation. I can't stress how important this is in terms of what's going on nationally, and I will in a moment speak to what is happening nationally. We have some information for you just to have the sense of what the context is legislatively. But all eyes, I think, are going to be on Oregon over the course of the next 18 months. What you do this session, the next session that you have, how you process the what will be 3.5 years of experience in Colorado and Washington as you help Oregon reach the point where it launches in the summer of 2016. Being able to do this right, keeping faith with the Citizens Initiative, and I've spent, as some of you know, a long time on this issue. I actually voted for legalization in the 1973 session, before any of you were born, when Oregon became the first state to decriminalize marijuana. And I've been working on it over the years since then. We have an opportunity with what happens in Oregon to have, I think, not just keeping faith with the Oregon voters, but it's going to make a difference dealing with what happens around the country. California, Nevada, maybe Missouri. There are a number of states that will be moving in this direction over the course of the next 2 years, and very likely to be several on the ballot. Being able to do this right, to be able to protect the integrity of the Oregon Act, what Oregonians have voted for, and the opportunities for Oregon, both in terms of a new emerging industry, dealing with what happens with medical marijuana. These are items that are going to have, I think, significant consequences. The marijuana reform train has left the station. There are now 213 million Americans who live in jurisdictions that to some extent have authorized legal use of marijuana for some variant of medical marijuana, for adult use. 34 jurisdictions, 34 states and the District of Columbia. So it's something that is happening very, very quickly. And this is an area of bipartisan cooperation in Congress, where we've seen some significant progress that is made. I have passed out made available to the committee, I don't know if you have it, a matrix of the legislation that includes the 17 bills that were introduced in the last Congress. Almost all of them were bipartisan. Four were the principal author was a Republican. In the last Congress, We had 79 members of both parties co-sponsor at least one of the bills. There was substantial involvement, particularly on a bipartisan basis, with the hemp legislation. We had 6 amendments voted on the floor of the House, every one of which was in favor of expanding or not limiting the marijuana reform efforts with hemp, veterans and medical marijuana, descheduling, bank regulations. There's a lot of movement, and I think you're going to see more. I would say that I am encouraged that we will be able to deliver some real progress in this Congress on 2 nuts and bolts issues that make a big difference in terms of the industry being able to operate, serving the 213 million people who are in jurisdictions that allow it. One deals with the amendment or the repeal of the 280E. This is something that is a result of a drug dealer who used his yacht to smuggle cocaine in the 70s and tried to deduct it on his income tax, and Congress sprang into action, made that illegal. But the wording of the legislation for the 280E was so broad that it included legal marijuana businesses. And as a result, we have a dramatic unfairness in terms of their tax liability. I would note that this, too, is a bipartisan issue. When I introduced this legislation first last year, I was joined by Grover Norquist, the Republican tax advocate, who felt that it was outrageous that legal businesses would have this sort of penalty and that it undercut fairness, it undercut tax compliance, and it stifled the emergence of the industry. I am confident that we will be making progress on that. I think it's one of these pieces of legislation that that could, in fact, be enacted and possibly even this year. The second deals with the equally ludicrous policy of denying financial services to legal businesses. And as you know, there are real problems with the men and women, virtually all small businesses, trying to deal with meeting their business responsibilities. It's hard for them often to legally get a bank account across the country. And we have the specter of people, like in Colorado, where they were delivering their tax payments, and they've collected millions and millions of dollars in taxes in Colorado, with shopping bags of $20 bills. I mean, in what alternate universe is any policy advanced by forcing this to be in an all-cash business if you care about tax compliance, if you care about money laundering, if you care just about outright theft? And so there's, I think, wide understanding that this, too, needs to change. And so we will be focusing, while we have policy issues that ultimately will hopefully get rid of the ambiguity that Congress has allowed. In 42 years ago, the National Commission on Drug Policy, a federally sponsored activity, said that the scheduling as a Schedule I controlled substance made no sense. That was 42 years ago. It still makes no sense. And we need to make sure that we help clear up this ambiguity. Ultimately, the Congress needs to do it. It needs to be delisted. There are alternate ways of doing it. We will work on that. But in the meantime, we want to work with you to make sure that the emerging industry here in Oregon can be able to operate in a rational fashion. Again, I deeply appreciate your focus on this. We would be more than happy to help in any way that we can. Moving these forward in the federal level. If you have any questions about any of this legislation, we will periodically supply your committee with an update in terms of what is happening. And if there is any area that we can help with collaboration or clarification, we want to help, because this is critically important for our state and how this issue is going to unfold over the course of the next 5 years nationally.
That's right. Thank you. Senator Cruz.
Thank you. Thank you, Congressman. I listened earlier today to the speech you made on the floor on this subject. I thought it was rather succinct. I guess my question, I look at all these bills. The thing that would help us the most is if marijuana was a Schedule II. Rather than a schedule,
It is a Schedule II in the state of Oregon.
I'm talking nationally, okay. And so, how is there going to be a move to reschedule? To actually, I mean, we can talk about all sorts of things, but the simple thing would be just to reschedule it. Is there going to be a move for that? And
there is assuredly legislation to deal with rescheduling, delisting, going in and dealing with the fundamental classification that is outmoded and inappropriate. It clearly, I mean, it is tricky, but I think that we are nearing the period where this can be accomplished. It can be undertaken with the action of the administration in terms of dealing with the listing process, as well as legislation. I don't much care how it happens. I agree with you that it would solve all sorts of problems.
Yeah.
And we will continue working with these various approaches. And I agree with you that this really unravels the puzzle very quickly.
Yeah, Mr. Congressman, that move would simplify our work tremendously.
You have an active partner in that regard. Thank you, Senator.
Senator Prozanski.
Thank you, Congressman. As we've talked before and previously on issues involving marijuana and industrial hemp, thank you very much for you leading the way at the national level. I'll follow up on what Senator Cruz started off. You know, our state did, in fact, deschedule from a 1 to a 2 in 2009, so at least our patients here in the state have that protection. I'm assuming that as long as the federal government maintains its position on the Schedule 1, would you be telling us it would be best to us to maintain our individual program, in the sense of the medical marijuana, instead of collapsing it into a retail operation, because it does give more protection for patients, specifically when we have our marijuana schedule as a Schedule 2 versus a Schedule 1?
Well, Senator, you're going to be dealing with a host of issues that are caught up in this, and it's not just a case of some additional protections or not under federal law. I mean, we're working very hard to make sure that the federal government is not interfering with those 34 states and their medical marijuana programs. And I think we're making some progress, and I think the president and his administration have dialed that back, not as with as much clarity as I would like, but I think there's things moving forward. You have lots of considerations before you when you're dealing with issues of medical marijuana and adult use, and I appreciate that. Part of it is the clear language of the initiative that people voted on. There are consequences in terms of black market implications if there's a differential. I am hopeful, as I mentioned earlier, that you've got a year and a half before full implementation. You have the experience that's going on in other states that you can evaluate. You have access to the best experts nationally who will, I know, avail themselves to you as you try and weigh those competing interests. Far be it from me to make a judgment here one way or another. I think taking advantage of the information and the time and trying to balance these things out with the work of this committee, I'm confident you'll be able to fashion something that will work. And I hope that you take advantage of the time and the resources that are available to you.
One follow-up?
Yes, and then Representative Wilson. Thank you.
So the other thing is you mentioned about the issues that we have about banking, and understand that there's work as at the congressional level to change the statute. Is it possible, as the president did with an executive order allowing for states to have these type of operations ongoing, could he or his agency do an executive order that would give the safe harbor for those states that do in fact have laws that do allow for recreational use by adults?
I do think that there are administrative remedies.
Okay.
One of the things I would mention, one of the votes that passed with a bipartisan majority in the House of Representatives was to not have the federal government interfere in terms of the financing. There is in terms of in the enforcement of banking regulations. I think the administration could go further in terms of directives. I think that there are things that could happen within FDIC. I was somewhat vexed that an Oregon bank, that MBank, was providing services, or willing to provide services in Colorado, backed off. And I think there, and I sought clarification from FDIC on that. I think we are making this a lot harder than we should. I understand sensitivity for illegal activity, money laundering, but this has the perverse effect of actually making the problem worse, making it more likely that there will be money laundering, more likely that there will be tax evasion. And so I think there's a strong and compelling case for the administration to dial this back and give more latitude. But we'll continue to work legislatively, just with several bills that we have, again, that are bipartisan. Having the administration in its final 2 years not unduly complicated, and I hope that they will so act.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we have time for one last question from Representative Wilson, and then we'll move into some of the next parts of our agenda.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Congressman, thank you. Appreciate you being here. I approach this from being on a bank board of directors, and we discuss this from time to time. When you look at the issue regarding the denying of financial services to this industry, what really is the biggest objection? What's the biggest mountain to climb when you look at this legislatively in Congress?
I think the biggest mountain to climb is that most people haven't focused on the practical realities. I think when, and we're seeing now, as you know, they're now, as I mentioned, 34 states in the District of Columbia. I think as people focus on these realities, I think there will be more receptivity to providing the clarity that financial institutions want and deserve and the industry requires. There is hesitancy because we've been in this era of drug trafficking and illegal money movement that has, for security purposes, where you don't want to be funding Al-Qaeda. I mean, we've really ramped up, as you know, as a member of a bank board, there's great sensitivity to that. But I think in this case, it may have just gone a little beyond the pale. But having people focus on the direct consequences and then working realistically with the industry that's emerging that just wants financial services and being able to be honest, and with the banks that I think are trying to fulfill their responsibilities within the scope of the law, I think there's room here to refine that so that we don't have these problems.
All right. Thank you.
Well, Congressman, thank you so much for visiting with us today.
Well, thank you for the courtesy of joining you, and you all know where I live. So if there are things that come up, feel free to contact me or our team, and I would look forward, either formally or informally, to visiting with you in the course of your deliberations later. As I say, this is important work. This is a terrific committee, and we look forward to working with you in any way we can.
Thank you. Thanks for your leadership. All right, so we're going to move now into the next part of our agenda. Just to be clear, we have three panels or components of testimony tonight. First, we're going to talk about licensing parameters, kind of the open questions in licensing, and we have a few different speakers who are going to offer their thoughts on elements they really want to see be part of or not part of a licensing process. Then we're going to talk about opting out. We'll have a brief description of what opting out process is, and then hear from some local jurisdictions about concerns they have about the existing process. And then finally, a taxes and revenue conversation in which we'll hear a summary of what the elements are under Measure 91 and then why they came to be that way, why we have, for example, taxes applied where we do and in the amounts we have, and then open it up for some expression of concern about what the current tax structure is and look at a couple of other possibilities in the event people felt the need to go that way. So I'll start by inviting OLCC Chair Rob Patridge and Tom Burns, who's the Director of Marijuana Programs for OLCC, to come join us to give a brief overview, please, of what the licensing open questions are that you see. And then we'll follow with Jeff Anderson and TJ Lorenzen from UFCW. I know that you have to be in another hearing in 15 minutes or so. And then we'll move to Sam Groves and Amy Margolis. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being here today. Chair Patridge, welcome.
Thank you. Co-Chair Leininger and members of the committee, we're here today because you asked us to talk about licensing types. Tom Burns is certainly the detailed expert related to some of the deep dive questions that the committee may have. But just as an overview, the Measure 91 provided.
May I jump in? If you could introduce yourself for the record.
Rob Patridge, Chair of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. So there are four basic license types that were allowed as a result, and the agency given the responsibility for as a result of the passage of Measure 91. Those four types, starting with the producer, meaning generally the person who grows the marijuana, the processor, meaning the person who processes, packages the marijuana. It includes compounding and the conversion of products into extracts. The OLCC does see some issues related to the processor license types. We'd like ultimately to probably have some subcategories of licensing types for the processor types, so we can maybe, because they're very different in their very typography. We're trying to work through what we want those to look like exactly, but we do have some good ideas related to those. And then the wholesaler, which would be a typical wholesaler who would aggregate marijuana from several processors and producers, probably, and then the retail level license. Those are the licensing types that we currently have. The OLCC is in the process. We have our OLCC meeting next week. We are in the process of trying to lay out for the committee categorically three kind of those items that we need to have as a technical fix. Those things would be items like on the processor side, having some subcategories of processor license type. Those are some things that we feel like maybe technical fixes. Then we would lay out those items, which the commission is going to recommend that the legislature look at making some kind of adoption. And finally, then, just some of the items that we've picked up around the state as we've traveled the state related to items that have been brought to our attention that the committee may want to consider, kind of a panoply of what those are, not a lot of detail. But that's kind of our plan as we continue to move forward. You know, some of the other things we're seeing, the licensing, we've also obviously talked about a testing license internally at OLCC, that we would have to have some type of licensing for people who were testing product potentially. We've talked to this committee before when we appeared before as to whether there's an interest in some kind of service permit type of license. We just testified in front of the budget committee today. We we do about 15% compliance checks on liquor items and have about a 81% compliance rate. So 19%, or about 90 people of those we test, fall outside under just minor sales. So those are issues that I think this committee will want to consider as we continue to move forward. But there are a variety of other licensing types. Tom can talk to, and I know we're supposed to talk about the R&D license as well, but Tom's going to talk.
You know what, I'll jump in. Since we have a lot of witnesses, I want to make sure I give you clear information about what we're hoping that you'll cover.
Okay, great.
I think that we would love to have you identify for the group what you see as the key open policy questions, drawing from, for example, policy questions or decisions about what kinds of parameters there are on licensing, say in Colorado or here, just to tee up the question, and then we're going to have some community members speak to their perspective on what they'd like to see as some of the key policy considerations as you decide how you issue licenses. So we have about five more minutes for the two of you, and then each of the next speakers has about 5 minutes.
Madam Co-Chair, members, I'm Tom Burns, Director of the Marijuana Program for the OLCC. I think there are a couple things. One is, as the chair has mentioned, there is no license test. And I think we've talked about that under the testing or the laboratory issue, and I think that's something that you're aware of and you need to address. The other one is the whole question of R&D and whether there should be a specific license to allow R&D. I know Colorado has not issued a specific R&D license, but instead issued grants to the tune of about $8 million to do R&D around the medical side. That was their way of addressing it. I think there's a couple other things that become important as you look at this. One is the fee structure. We've talked about the fee in Oregon, which, as you know, is $250 and $1,000 application and $1,000 for the license. Washington mirrors us. At Colorado, it's $5,000 for a retail license, $3,000 to be a grow, and $2,200 if you want to be a tester. On the medical side in this state, it's $4,000 to get a license. So you have some disparities on license. As far as the privilege of those licenses, as Chair Patridge said, the key issue, in our opinion, is the processor license. It is so broad that it could be perceived that even the grower who puts their product in a package to batch it for selling down the pipeline would need a processor license as well. And so we would encourage you to look at the processor license and re-examine it and either give specific privileges or break it up into multiple licenses. So if you want to be a kitchen, you are a kitchen and you're only a kitchen, and that's all you're going to do. If you want to be a grower, you don't have to have a processor license in order to grow. I think those are the key areas that we've looked at. The wholesaler is really weak in the law. I think we all know what a wholesaler is. You might want to look at that. The other states do have wholesalers who are equally as weak in their law, and so it may be that the drafters of 91 simply didn't have anything else to look at other than a wholesaler.
I would love to hear your thoughts on, I believe Colorado has a two-year residency requirement in order to get a license. Is that unique to Colorado? Have you identified, I know people consider things like background checks or residency requirements or perhaps successful performance under the OMMP. Are there any policy considerations like that that you're toying with?
Madam Co-Chair, I would say that the OLCC doesn't, I would say from the commission level, I'm not sure that the commission feels like we have the right to restrict a license based on that, and that I think that we're open to potentially some legal liability related to those, related to a residency type of requirement. If that was a consideration that the legislature gave us broad authority to do, we certainly would do that. We have certainly seen that on the road as we have gone to these listening sessions. There is certainly a strong interest in preserving Oregon's marijuana industry as it exists. So we have certainly heard that. We have certainly heard 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, all kinds of residency requirements. So that's certainly a consideration. I think the other thing that I would like to add, though, related to marijuana licensing is I think it's a really tough policy decision that the legislature puts itself in. We have been able to I would say that our alcohol laws in the state of Oregon, because they're narrowly defined, have limited the Liquor Commission's ability to meet market movement on a quick basis. We've had to kind of do some double somersault, backflip kinds of things to try and get things licensed. And depending on the authority, I think the commission is really committed to making sure both on the alcohol and the marijuana side that we do things. But giving the commission some broader discretion to draw things, because this is an emerging industry, if the legislature is comfortable with that, may be a better way to look at as we continue to define this license, so that the OLCC as a commission, since it's approved by the Senate, appointed by the governor, can move liberally as we move to work within licensing categories.
I see we have questions from Senator Cruz and Senator Prozanski, and then I think we're going to need to actually move to our next witnesses to make sure that we can.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. This isn't actually a question. It's something I'm going to ask Tom to look into, because you talked about R&D, and I'm very interested in that. I think it would behoove us to look to the state of Washington, because I do think they have some R&D going on at UW up there, I believe. But check into that, because if they're doing that, and we could dovetail OHSU with the med school up there and get double bang for the buck, I think that's something worth looking into.
Great, Senator Prozanski.
Yeah, and just follow up on the part about residency. I really think it's for us, the legislature, to set a policy, put it in statute, not put it on the burden, an agency to come up with something through rulemaking. Second is regarding licenses. I've not heard about seeds. I personally think we need a seed license for people who are dealing with seeds and making certain that they're covered, unless there's going to be some other place. And to me, this is going to be one of those boutique abilities for people to have seed for a particular type of product, and it seems to me that in itself is going to be a commerce that we need to be looking at.
Madam Co-Chair and Senator Prozanski, we have heard on the seed issue, as well as nurseries have come forward related to starts, and so there's some interest. There's certainly some interest there, because we have such a huge nursery industry. So Great. Those are issues that we certainly would want to deal with from a licensing perspective, but based on what we have, it's kind of difficult to maneuver in that context. So,
well, thank you again. With our 101 level overviews of some of these really meaty topics, we don't get to delve into it as much as we'd like to, but that was very helpful framing, and we'll be hearing from at least one of you later. I don't know if you're heading back.
I'm here
now. Okay, great. We'll hear from you a little bit later in the day then.
Thanks.
Next, I'd like to call up to the table Jeff Anderson and T.J. Lorenzen. I know that you have to be in the paid sick leave hearing soon, so we're going to skip ahead and then go back and have Sam Gross and Amy Margolis do that. Welcome. Thank you for being here today. And we've asked that you provide us with your view about some considerations you'd like to have this body be thinking of as we provide guidance on licensing parameters. And please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Anderson. I'm Secretary Treasurer of United Food and Commercial Workers, Local 555. It's Oregon's largest private sector local union, with about 20,000 members in diverse occupations in terms of agricultural processing, retailing, and healthcare and pharmaceutical dispensing. I want to come at this in two kind of points, and I'm going to rely on TJ, who comes from our international office, who's working in all the states creating these new policies. But one component is a component called labor piece that we think should be in a policy. The reason being, the National Labor Relations Act does not acknowledge this industry. And so Oregonians in this industry have no legal protections of workers' rights. And we believe a labor peace component would put it in, and that's under consideration in other government entities as we speak. The main thrust is a merit-based system rather than a lottery. We believe that a merit-based system is one that will provide that there's community standards, whether it's residency, but other elements And that the UFCW is on record as supporting a seed-to-sale tracking system as well. But for tonight, I think it would be good to spend our limited time having TJ talk about the merit-based system and his experience.
Thank you. And you have about 5 minutes before we need to transition. Okay. Thanks and welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, co-chairs and members of the assembly. TJ Lartson with United Food and Commercial Workers International Union, Washington, D.C. One of the things that we'd like to talk about is a merit-based application, or in some states it's called a qualified applicants list. And basically what it does is it rewards people who have in the past shown that they can deal in a regulated industry, they can work in a regulated industry, follow the rules, that they can they'll treat their workers right, that they treat their communities where they operate right, that they treat the environment right. All of these elements of a merit-based application. And we worked on that merit-based application with the University of California at Berkeley and an attorney named Mark Terbeek, and he put that application process together for the city of Oakland when we first started to organize in California. So in that city of Oakland, they went from 114 dispensary locations to 6. So it was very, very, the points that people were able to acquire through the application process were very instrumental in determining who got those licenses. So we think that you should reward the operators that show that they have the best business plan, that they would have a best capitalization plan, a best community benefits plan, a labor and employment standards plan, environmental practice plan, and product safety plan for customers. And if you would please acknowledge that there's a lot of folks that have been doing business in the medical marijuana industry here that know how to do the work already and should be given some consideration if they've been able to operate under this regulated system and been able to do it well. And I thank you for your time. Any questions?
Any questions? Yes, Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. At least some elements of law enforcement believe that a tremendous amount of a product that's being prepared purportedly for the medical distribution system is being diverted. And it's one of those situations where the regulatory agencies are anxious to have the whole industry under the umbrella of regulation to prevent that diversion and to legitimize what has been a quasi-legal system. Right. Do you have some recommendations to make to the committee about the kind of background checks that would need to be done so that we can determine who legitimate operators are, who've met the spirit and the letter of the law, mm-hmm. and identify and differentiate them from others who have participated in the diversion of medical product to the recreational market?
And most of the states now are turning to the FBI background check system, and they just got Illinois cleared day before yesterday to do that background checks on the Illinois providers that are just licensed. So there is healthy background checks that you can run on folks, and for sure if they've been tempted in the past to wander off into the black market, it's not somebody that you want under a regulated market holding a license.
Oh, Madam Chair, just that.
All right, then.
Madam Chair, follow-up?
Yes, sir.
So if I'm hearing your recommendation, you would say that if there was evidence that somebody has participated in diversion of product from the medical side to the recreational side, that they should not be allowed.
Absolutely. I believe they should not be granted a license to continue that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any follow-up questions? All right. Thank you so much for being here and for your innovative thinking about how we can protect workers as we move into a new territory. Appreciate it.
Thanks,
Adam. All right. Now we have two additional witnesses on this topic, Amy Margolis of the Emerge Law Firm and Sam Gross, who is also an attorney. If the two of you could come to the front, please. We would love to have you speak about what you see as useful Parameters for licensing, things you'd like to have be considered, things you think it would be inappropriate to consider. And then, Amy, I think we were going to ask you to talk a little bit about an idea I know you've been looking into for a research and development license. We have about 5 minutes per person for testimony. Thanks. Welcome, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chairs and members of the committee. My name is Samuel Gross, and I'm an attorney. And I've also been operating for almost the previous two decades in regulated businesses in the state of Oregon, ranging from moving and storage, real estate, and food manufacturing, all businesses of which are heavily regulated by this state. First, I'd like to kind of put a framework when looking at licensing requirements as to what those requirements should be, and there should be a balancing test, because the purpose of a license generally is to prevent the public from unnecessary risk in the activity. This is balanced with, as we increase the licensing requirements, we incentivize people to operate outside of the regulatory framework, and we perpetuate a black market. Specifically, Measure 91 was addressed to prevent the negative effects of a black market within this state. So therefore, whatever measure we put in place for licensure should be balanced against the incentive to operate outside of it. Briefly, operating within the moving and storage industry, in 2009, the Oregon State Legislature made a fundamental shift in its policy to granting moving licenses. Prior to that time, licenses were restricted and very difficult to obtain an additional license. What this created was a large gray market that created a cat and mouse game between the police trying to catch unregulated movers and expose the public to the risk of having unregulated movers who were not properly insured or had proper equipment to move. After 2009, a shift was made. If you were ready, able, and willing, that you could obtain a license. This greatly increased the public safety by ensuring that all movers were licensed, and they came into the system merely having to show that they were ready, able, and willing, as opposed to having a showing of an economic need. I'd like to briefly touch on a couple of lessons that Washington has seen happen up in Washington, having dealt with people and businesses operating within Washington's regulatory framework that is currently in place right now. Washington came out with an unlimited number of producer licenses subject to a 2 million square foot canopy and a limited number of retail licenses. This mismatch of licenses and demand in the created large fluctuations in the price of marijuana in the state of Washington. The large fluctuations in the price creates artificial pricing in the market and makes it very difficult for businesses entering into the market to plan and properly allocate capital resources. Finally, I'd like to discuss a category of license that has not been currently available, which is on-site consumption. I think that on-site consumption is necessary. People do want to gather and share the experience of marijuana together. The measure says that it shall not be consumed in any public place. It has enumerated places, but there is some ambiguity into what a public place could be considered. Can a cafe exist or not? And also, can in the license ability of that. Second of all, is that with no on-site consumptions, if a business is operating as a grower, producer, wholesaler, there's no ability to do product testing or consuming of samples or anything within the industry itself. When we look at edibles and things of that nature, like any other food manufacturing business, the industry should be allowed to sample products, try each other's products, so that the best products actually do reach it to market. I'd like to thank you for your time.
All right, thanks very much. And then we'll take questions at the end if people have questions.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you again for the opportunity to testify tonight. My name is Amy Margolis, and I'm attorney in town, actually not this town, up in Portland, and I represent the Oregon Growers PAC. I actually wrote my testimony down very clearly tonight because I knew I had a very short period of time. I've been asked to speak about adding a fifth license to ballot measure 91. Currently, you heard there are four licenses: producer, processor, wholesaler, and retail. I'd like to talk to you about adding a research and development license. I view this as the most unique opportunity this committee has moving forward. These would be focused, and we've worked with scientists and people at Oregon State University and labs who have been working in this industry to come up with a concept around this idea. And the idea would be to create a research and development license that focuses on three areas of research: plant sciences, plant inputs, and medical research. We focused on these three segments because they encompass the true needs of the research community. In reaching out to partners in the scientific and medical community, and by continuing to engage them in this process, a fifth license could move the cannabis industry in Oregon forward in a way that no other state with recreational cannabis has done. I want to talk about what each of those subsections would do to help move not only Oregon and its medical community forward, but the whole community around the development of a cannabis economy. In terms of medical research, Oregon has the opportunity to be on the forefront of true medical research regarding cannabis. As a leader in other types of medical research, it is time that we fully understand the true potential of cannabis. While we know that medical use of cannabis has been successful for treating MS, epilepsy, PTSD, and other serious and life-changing conditions, Oregon has the opportunity, the unique and special opportunity, to take that knowledge deeper. This would allow Oregonians to be on the front end of developing new products and helping people who are truly suffering. Plant sciences. This is a kind of product development. When we talk about the research and development, this is really a product development license. This allows individuals to cultivate, and I've been calling it a not-for-market cultivation. This would allow individuals to cultivate, who cultivate, to learn more about what works and what doesn't work for growing. It includes study around genetics, tissue culture, and learning how to grow cannabis safely and effectively. It goes hand in hand with medical by allowing people to study the medical and physiological effect of dozens of naturally occurring cannabinoid molecules. Finally, the inputs piece. This is an unexpected piece of this licensing process. This is, and I know that the committee has talked about residency requirements, this is a little different. This reaches out to traditional industries like soil manufacturers and nutrient manufacturers, people who are not necessarily touching cannabis. And while I anticipate there will be a residency requirement that this committee will move, this would be an opportunity to bring support businesses to Oregon, to bring a different piece of the economy to Oregon. And what I mean when I say that is that this type of research would be focused on traditional parts of plant cultivating, understanding nutrients, soil, and other traditional inputs. So while we are working on allowing Oregonians the opportunity to get started in the cannabis industry out of the gate, this might be a way to reach out to other businesses and bring them here as well. This is an opportunity to look at what inputs are the most effective, how they impact the usefulness of the plant, and what kind of growing conditions are best. I mean, we, again, are geographically unique as well. We have outdoor, greenhouse, and indoor cultivation. This makes Oregon a fabulous place to do this input piece of this research. So I appreciate the opportunity to speak to the committee. I think that if you create with input from very smart people in the industry and people on the outside of the industry and traditional research positions, when those two things meet each other, those two groups come together, this committee has a fabulous opportunity. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm very intrigued by this. Have you gotten to the point yet where you're talking about how logistically the research would happen, the number of plants that a researcher would be allowed to have, et cetera, transportation of plants, the handling of the marijuana?
So, Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, we have had, and we are actually meeting on Wednesday with a group of people, We have started having that conversation, and the reason why we've broken it down, at least conceptually, into those three pieces is because each of those have unique cultivation right. needs. So, I mean, you may, for medical research, you may be saying, I'm going to cultivate 1,000 of these particular plants, I'm going to do a bunch of processing, I'm going to pull the oil, and then I'm going to destroy what I've grown and processed, or I'm going to test it. And so there are unique pieces for each of this. It is a very, I think it will be an interesting and detail-specific process. We've started working on it, and we are trying to pull experts from each of those areas to get some guidance on how you as a committee might work towards fulfilling each of those roles.
Excellent. All right. Well, thank you so much. Any other questions, Senator Farioli?
Just for the record, Madam Chair, are we hearing from you, either member of the panel, that you're inviting the committee to go beyond mere implementation of Measure 91? You've asked us to add another license. There could be other critical considerations.
So, Madam Chair, Senator Farioli, I don't speak on behalf of Ballot Measure 91. I speak on behalf of the Oregon Growers PAC. And I expect that during this session, we will ask you to go beyond the ballot measure in many different ways.
Madam Chair, I characterize that as a yes. Thank you.
Duly noted. All right. Thank you both for your time and for your work on this issue. Any other questions before we dismiss the panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. So now we are transitioning to a next topic area. And actually, Sam Groats, we dismissed you too soon because you are also up for the next panel, which has to do with opting out. And I'd also like to invite Rob Bovet, legal counsel for the Association of Oregon Counties, to the table. In this panel, we are inviting you to describe, and Sam, if you are in a position to go first and describe what the opting out framework is, that would be great. And then, Rob, we'd love to have you describe what your clients see as some key concerns that they want us to be aware of in terms of the opting out structure. And then I think there may be some questions about this because it's quite an interesting area. All right, Sam, let's have you start. Again, introducing yourself, please.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chairs and members of the committee. My name is Samuel Gross.
Thank you.
What I'd like to say is Oregon got this right, and it's not a mistake that this is right in the way it should be, because this opt-out provision was lifted pretty much right from the opt-out provisions for a county or a local jurisdiction if they wanted to opt out of liquor sales. This is a framework that's been around in the state for a number of years. The other thing it does is that it's a clear opt-out. It's an all or nothing. Either you have a majority vote of the jurisdiction to opt out, or you don't opt out. It does not allow a jurisdiction to kind of pick and choose the pieces that they like and they don't like. This clarity is very important, because when you look at California has been silent on this issue at a state level. And so therefore, each jurisdiction has regulated the industry, and you have a morass of different regulations, which causes confusion among those operating in the industry and creates inefficiencies in the businesses who operate across, throughout the state. Also, when you look at Washington was silent on whether local jurisdictions could regulate. And so that has created a plethora of litigation between private individuals and the state local municipalities on what they can and cannot and what they should and they should not regulate. So making the rules clear prevents litigation and also creates efficiency in the marketplace. Second of all, I'd like to address the local taxes, is that Measure 91 expressly prohibits these. These should not be allowed to stand, because effectively, if you look at a jurisdiction like Fairview has passed a 40% tax rate, it creates an end run around the opt-out procedure that was put in Measure 91. Finally, the will of the voters, I think, is very important here. I've heard anecdotally that the voters just passed a measure to create recreational marijuana. But if we go back in our history only a couple of years, Measure 80 effectively created a recreational marijuana regime, but without many of the safeguards that Measure 91 has in place. People cared about how recreational marijuana came into the state and how it's going to be regulated in the state. That's why Measure 91 passed, I believe, in large part. But I'd like to cut to the crux of the matter here with the opt-out provisions. Is what I think a lot of people care about is the case where you have a county or a city or a jurisdiction that would ultimately opt out in a popular vote, but yet due to the timing of when the OLCC is going to issue licenses, a license would be issued to an operator who would operate inside of that jurisdiction, begin operating, and then have to wait for anywhere 6 months to a year when a general election came around, and then they would lose the privilege of operating. Who are the stakeholders in this type of regime? First of all, you look at the jurisdiction itself. The jurisdiction may say, we have to create rules and regulations to regulate this business, and this is an undue burden for a business that's going to be here for a scant amount of time. But currently, under the medical regime, those rules and regulations have to be in place, and I would surmise in large part that those rules and regulations would carry over to a recreational market. Second of all, you look at the risk to the business or the business owner that's going to be operating that may be able to operate for a short amount of time and then be denied. Going into it, every business owner who's getting a license is tasked with knowing and understanding the law. This is an area that he should be aware of. And furthermore, anybody that's operating in this space realizes that at every general election, they could be denied a license. This is the risk of doing business. This is also the same risk that every bar owner in the state undergoes, that under a general election, a county or a municipality could decide to be dry and they would lose their license. And thirdly, you look at the citizens of Oregon. Measure 91 was to prevent the negative impacts of having an unregulated business. By a county opting out effectively or a jurisdiction opting out, effectively what they're saying is we would rather have the negative impacts of having an unregulated marijuana business within our jurisdiction than enjoying the benefits of having a regulated industry within our jurisdiction. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much. Mr. Beauvais, if you could introduce yourself for the record, please, and it looks like we've got a PowerPoint.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, I'm Rob Beauvais, legal counsel for the Association of Oregon Counties. Probably comes as no surprise I have a slightly different take than that you've just heard, and I'll just walk you through it real quickly. This is my disclaimer. I'm unavoidably going to be giving my legal opinion. I can't help it, because I got to be interpreting pieces of Measure 91 and apply those to municipal law, which I've been practicing for a couple of decades now. So the only people entitled to rely upon my opinions is my client, Association of Oregon Counties. I do have a 24-point plan for you. I'm not going to go through any of it except for part of one, but it's in the packet that I've handed you out, and I would encourage you to read through that, and I think you'll find a lot of common areas of interest with many of the players that you've heard from before. So what's in Measure 91? Let's talk about what's in there relating to local control and opt-out, other than taxes, which I'm going to defer to my colleague from the League of Oregon City, Scott, which is your next panel and your final topic for the evening. So I'm not going to get into taxes. I'm going to start here with Section 58. As the previous speaker noted, this was pulled almost verbatim out of the Oregon Liquor Control Act of the mid-30s. Keep in mind, this came shortly on the heels of the elimination of prohibition. It borrowed from statutes that predated prohibition, and it was done in the context of a kind of a scramble of local ordinances. This is not really a preemption clause. This is not how we would write a preemption clause today. It probably wouldn't survive judicial scrutiny as a preemption clause under current home rule law in the state of Oregon. What it is it's kind of a slate-clearing tool. It cleared off everything that was on the books in cities and counties in 1935 that was inconsistent, and that's the key word, inconsistent with specific provisions of the Liquor Control Act. It's a very odd structure. I don't think it meets the standard, but we could argue about that, but that's really moot, because really what it boils down to is this, and I'm going to give you, pardon me, 22nd version of home rule in the state of Oregon. There are two kinds of states in the United States. There's Dillon's Rule States and there's Home Rule States. Dillon's Rule States, named after a famous judge from Iowa, federal district judge who wrote one of the big treatises on municipal laws back in the late 1800s. My colleague, Sean O'Day from League of Oregon Cities, refers to a Dillon state as a show me where I can. This is basically where a city or a county in a Dillon's Rule state has to be able to point to a statute that authorizes it to act. It is limited to those things that the legislature has said it can do. We are not a Dillon's Rule state, haven't been for quite some time now. We're a Home Rule state. We're a show me where I can't state. And a lot of people confuse these and get quite confused by it. But this is basically where we have inherent powers, counties and cities, unless you, the legislature, says we can't do something. You have to preempt us specifically. So assuming that Section 58 is preemptive, which I don't necessarily think it is, basically it says that anything that's on the books in charters and ordinances that is inconsistent with anything in Sections 3 to 70 is in fact repealed effectively. So it's not a standard preemption by any stretch. We have to show a direct conflict in order to actually have the ordinance gone. And keep that in mind for what I'm going to talk about here next. Section 59 is another interesting piece that was pulled basically verbatim out of the Oregon Liquor Control Act. And it talks about reasonable time, place, and manner regulations of the nuisance aspects of marijuana businesses. But then it says in subsection 2, which is exactly what the original Liquor Control Act said, this is additional powers granted to cities and counties and is not attempted to limit those powers. So the way I analyze it, it's permissive. This is a supplemental authority. It contains no preemptive language whatsoever, and it even says it's supplemental. Section 60, this is the local option. This was pulled, again, almost verbatim out of the mid-30s Oregon Liquor Control Act. What I think the crafters of Measure 91 may not have realized is this is actually implementing legislation of our Constitution. Because when we did a whole bunch of constitutional amendments relating to liquor, one of the things that's in there is a directive to the legislature to create a method for a local election opt-out, essentially going dry or going wet, either way. But we don't have that same context in the Oregon Constitution. So there's nothing in the opt-out provision that is preemptive. It contains no exclusive language. It implies that there's nothing in it that implies that you can't use another methodology for opt-out because there's no constitutional provision. So this is not preemptive. It basically says what happens if a city or a county receives an initiative petition to opt out. I also disagree with the characterization that it's an opt-out or opt-in of everything. That's not how this provision worked under the Liquor Control Act. We had a number of cities using the opt-out provision in various fashions. There's an attorney general's position on point where various businesses were restricted or not restricted under the statute. And then there's this one. There's Section 61, which basically says that nothing about opting out would prohibit. So, for example, if I purchase marijuana in Portland and I drive to some city that has opted out, there's nothing that prohibits me from possessing it. So really, the opt-out is really opting out of businesses and classes of businesses only. And then, finally, I'll just mention Section 62. It basically says, again, verbatim out of the Liquor Control Act, after the November general election vote, the opt-in or opt-out becomes effective January 1st following the day of election. And I think that's important because it says results for or against, so you can be opting in or out, and based on the case law of various types of businesses. And then I just mentioned this, which is thrown in at the end, because somebody might argue that two of those sections were preemptive based on a common reading or implicit reading of the section captions. But Measure 91 itself makes it clear that the section captions are not law and cannot be used for legislative intent. So that doesn't help either. So where am I at? I'm not sure that Measure 91 is preemptive at all. I think cities and counties have full local options to opt out of any one or more of these four types of businesses right now. But I fully concede we'll have to litigate it. because this is messy language, and I don't think the crafters of 91 were realizing the context in which this legislation was crafted in terms of implementing those provisions of the Constitution relating to liquor. I also think we need to learn lessons from Colorado. Colorado has local opt-out enshrined in their Constitution. So, and the second most important message that I received when I was in Colorado 3 weeks ago from the Colorado folks that I spoke with, both dispensary operators and various other government folks, is after they tout the big problem they want to fix, which I can mention if you want, they tout as one of their successes the success of local option. And I won't talk about Colorado counties, although I've learned quite a bit about them. I'll talk about one of our counties. I'll talk about Josephine County, which if I were looking into a crystal ball, and I certainly can't speak for Josephine County or any of the cities there, I could very well envision the city of Grants Pass saying, you know what, we want retail, don't mind some processing, but we don't want the warehouses growing. And opting out of that, the opting out of essentially what is the manufacturing license. But I could very well see, I would very well project, that Josephine County would opt in to manufacture, maybe even some processing, but not really want retail shops out in unincorporated county. This is local option. This is local control. This is exactly what's happening in many counties in Colorado. Voidance of litigation. I just as soon not litigate everything I just showed you. To me, it's a murky mess. We're already litigating the murky mess that is the possible preemptions or not preemptions of local control over medical marijuana dispensaries. I don't want to be doing Cave Junction 3 and Cave Junction 4 if I can help it. So please help me not do that. I don't mind trial litigation, but I just as soon not do this. And then avoidance of the nuclear option. And I'm only going to spend one brief moment. The last two pages of my written testimony go into what I'm very concerned with. Of the 34 states that Congressman Blumenauer mentioned, not all have dispensaries, but every single state that has a medical marijuana dispensary or that has retail dispensaries or retail system has local opt-out, whether it's enshrined in the Constitution, whether it's California Supreme Court case law in California, whether it's trial court case law in Washington. But I think we're headed to a different path. We're headed to a confrontation, and it's a confrontation I just as soon avoid. The very first speaker you heard from as a committee was Mark Mayer from Legislative Council. And he laid out something, and I think about it this way too, because this is what the case law tells me. I call it the scale of risk, and I think he called it a scale too. There are very safe things that you can do that the case law, 10th Amendment and otherwise, is very clear. Congress, it is beyond the reach of Congress to tell you what you can criminalize or can't criminalize or decriminalize or can't decriminalize. Beyond the reach of Congress. So to the extent that you, you just lost it, you get the idea. To the extent, you can turn the lights on because that was my last slide. So to the extent that the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act and Measure 91, at their core, they really are granting exemptions from state criminal law and decriminalizing certain things. All the personal allowance provisions of Measure 91, that's the core of what they do. Congress can't stop you from doing that. On the opposite end is an example that Mark gave you, which stems from the Emerald Steel case, which is where you get into a lot riskier behavior is when you are either forcing...
Board of House Bill 2005, I appreciate the opportunity, Mr. Chairman, to say a couple of brief comments. I know you have a very full witness list.
Less than 30 seconds.
You've heard...
Not sure what that is.
I think he's going to wrap up, and then Senator Farrelly has a question.
Yeah. So what's real risky is when you're requiring somebody or some entity to do something they don't want to do. Because what you're going to do is back them into a corner, and they're going to go into federal court, and they're going to get an injunction shutting down your ability to license. Because what these licenses are at their core are licenses to commit a federal crime. We may not like that, but that's what they are at a core. And that's what Emerald Steel tells us you can't force people to do.
So thank you. We have a question from Senator Farrelly, and then we have a question from Representative Helm.
This question for Mr. Bovet, Madam Chair. So if I understood what you were saying is that a city council or a county commission could prohibit by ordinance without a vote of the people.
Co-Chair Senator Farrelly, that is my current reading of the legal impact of Measure 91's purported preemption provisions.
Okay, and... Madam Chair, follow up just to show the way my mind works. 10% of the electorate or 10% of the population?
Co-chair and Senator Farioli, it's 10% of the registered electors within that area that's proposing to have an election. So that's how many would have to sign the initiative.
So, Madam Chair, if the population of John Day, Oregon is 1,700, we could assume the registration would be half or maybe more than half that because of age and other conditions. So 80 signatures would be enough, perhaps, to enact a petition, but could the petition be to opt in?
Co-chair and Senator Farrell, absolutely. So essentially what the Liquor Control Act and why it used those for and against words is you can opt in or opt out, and at least by attorney general opinion, any of the types of businesses.
And Madam Chair, just one question for our other panelists.
Yes, sir.
In respecting the will of the voters, is it the opt-out that you'd expect us to respect? Because that would be by vote of the people.
Yes, I think it would be the opt-out. And then also, I mean, it's clear that if somebody if a jurisdiction opted, once they opted out, wanted to opt back in, that would be also a permissive reading.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Helm.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your testimony. This is for Mr. Bovet. And before positing this question, I just want to state that we've had discussions about Measure 91 already and agree on a great many of the items that you've brought to our attention tonight. And I don't want this to sound like a test question, but you have particular expertise in appellate law. And I would like, if you could, describe for the committee the difference between interpreting a ballot measure, like we have here, and interpreting a piece of statute that was adopted by a legislature itself. Because I think once we get through the first couple steps of statutory construction, there's an important difference that the committee needs to be aware of.
Co-chair and Representative Helm, I think the key difference is in legislative history and what the courts look to for legislative history. So while there may be some argument that you could look at what the voters had in mind by looking at the various documents that were in support of the measure or opposed to the measure, I'm not sure that the court gets past its first analysis in terms of the opt-out language itself. So there has to be some language on its face that is ambiguous. In my reading of the Measure 91 provisions relating to opt-out, they're not ambiguous to me. They're very clear as to what they say. They empower, basically they direct counties and cities to accept an initiative petition to opt in or opt out under these certain criteria. But what they don't say is that there isn't any other mechanism for opting out.
Thank you for that answer. And for the committee's benefit, and I'm sorry if I'm belaboring a point you've heard many times before, but with a ballot initiative, you have the entire voter's pamphlet and what is said in it that constitutes the legislative history here. That gets weighed a little bit more heavily when you look at ballot measures that have become statutory language. And again, we agree on many things, but I would caution the committee not to jump too quickly to the conclusion that we have to follow a strict statutory construction analysis here that locks us into the type of choices that Mr. Bovet has set forth this evening. I hope we can have more discussion on it.
Yes, definitely. Well, I would say I have a couple of thoughts on this I'd love to throw out to the group. I appreciate that your client's position is that you want to maintain maximum ability to each client would like to choose how they want to address this statute. I tend to agree with Representative Helm on that, but I think there are two interesting issues that our committee needs to be considering as to functional opt-outs, if not formal opt-outs, and those have to do with siting facilities. I think if it were the case that we were to, you know, there are some proposals to make it easier for communities to not have facilities anywhere in their community by having a mile distance from, say, a school or something like that. I think we have to be attentive to the idea that, you know, if you're going to functionally opt out by establishing siting restrictions that are so extreme that really no facility could operate in your community, that that you can't opt out in one way through citing decisions if you're just trying to not use the opt-out procedure set forth in the statute. So that's an interesting issue. And then the other thing I think we need to be aware of is legal facilities. We need to be attentive to whether or not communities should be able to not allow legal facilities in their communities, at least somewhere, because I think that there are ramifications for other sometimes unpopular but important community facilities that some communities might like to not have within their borders. And so there are a lot of ripple effects to our thinking around siting decisions and functional opt-outs. So with that, any other questions for our current panel? All right, then. Thank you both for being before us. And we are moving to our final panel. We have about 45 minutes left. And this is going to be a quick overview of some of the key tax and revenue issues. We have available to us by phone a gentleman who helped structure the way in which revenue taxation would happen under Measure 91. So we want to make sure we can talk to him. I would love to have Tom Burns come up, and Chair Patridge, if you are interested in coming up again too, you're certainly welcome to briefly describe how the tax is imposed here in Measure 91, and perhaps contrast how it is done in Colorado. And then we have a number of panelists, including Scott Winkles. Why don't you come sit? And Robert Whalen. And we'll have Pat join by phone. Is Robert Whalen here? Ah, wonderful. Thank you. So, Tom, if you'd like to kick us off, that would be great. And then we'll call upon Pat Oglesby.
Co-chairs and member, I'm Tom Burns, director of the marijuana program for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. I'll just set the stage quickly for you. I think you know this, but in Oregon, the tax is $35 per ounce at the grower when the grower sells the product. That translates into about $1.25 per gram. It is $10 for trim. And there is some need to define the word trim, but let's assume that we all know what trim is, and then $5 per plant. And again, these are what is sold at the grower. In Washington, it is levied at 25% of the price each time the product changes hands. So as you can well guess, it gets very high very quickly. In Colorado, it's 15% for each sale, plus a local sales tax of 10% based on the price that the state assumes marijuana is sold at. And that currently is translating at about $2,000 per pound or $4.50 per gram. You all know where it goes, so I won't go into that. While you're talking about taxes, I think it's important to not lose. How do I make this bigger? Oh, I know. I come here someplace and hit.
I think slideshow. Plus.
I hit slideshow. Nope, I'm lost. Anyway, what I wanted to do is spend a moment and talk about. See, the boss knows how to run the electronics that I can't run, to talk about revenues, because I think as any tax conversation has to be revenues. This slide is the Washington projected at revenue based on its taxes. The projections were so off, it takes two different charts to look at this. On the left-hand, on the right-hand side is the chart when the initiative passed, and it was assumed that they would generate about $37 million in taxes when the initiative first passed. A month. Think about that. In September of 14, they re-estimated the growth in the range of slightly less than $37 million in taxes. In point of fact, their revenue is coming in significantly less than that, in the range of, it started at less than $1 million and has now reached $4 million in taxes. So as you think about your tax stuff, don't forget to think about the impact on revenue. In Colorado, the same problem. In September, when the initiative passed, you can see they had a $60 million projection. In January of 14, that jumped to 100. In February, it was approaching 120. Real numbers started to come in. In May of 14, they had a new projection. You can see it come down in June of 14. And the last chart over there is the entire tax that was collected in Colorado for 2014. So the projections have been off in both of those states. This is where Colorado's marijuana revenue comes from. The bottom line is the excise tax, followed by the sales tax, followed by the license fee, and then their 2.9% sales tax. So this shows you over time where their revenues have come from. And then the last one is, let's assume that our revenue projection follows at the same level as Colorado. And we picked Colorado because they had an ongoing medical program the way Oregon does. And so that's why we picked this. You can see Colorado's line. Oregon, if it followed the same line based on population, would be the blue line down there in the amount of revenue that would be estimated that we would receive. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. So we have had some questions arise about why we have the tax at a grower level and whether that makes sense. And I think Pat Oglesby is a gentleman on the East Coast who helped the Measure 91 drafters decide where to put that revenue. I think we'd like to have him join us by phone briefly, then go to Mr. Whalen to talk about how it came to be the tax level that was chosen, and then Mr. Winkles to talk about some community concerns about other tax options. Hi, is this Mr. Oglesby?
It is. Hello, thanks. Yes.
Hi, I'm Ann Leininger. I'm co-chairing this meeting this evening in Salem, Oregon, regarding Oregon's implementation of our marijuana legalization statute for adult use.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us.
I've been watching you on the video.
Oh, have you? All right. Well, we would love to have you introduce yourself for the record and then speak to us a bit about how the decision was made to have the tax structured as it was in terms of where it was applied and perhaps the amount, although we have a gentleman from Eco Northwest here who can speak to the amount and that consideration, too.
Super. Thank you. Thanks for having me, Madam Chair and members. My name is Pat Oglesby. I'm a lawyer in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Some credentials. I did tax staff work in Washington, D.C. for the Joint Congressional Committee on Taxation and then served as Chief Tax Counsel of the Senate Finance Committee and recently worked on a report the RAND Corporation did for Vermont on marijuana legalization. And I did help the drafters of Measure 91 think about marijuana tax, and I'm glad that Measure 91 collects tax by the ounce from the producer. Before you think about who pays the tax, that is the collection point, let me do some context, and you might think of marijuana tax issues in a hierarchy ranked like heart and artery and capillary. The heart is the money the state collects. The artery is the transmission method, the tax base, what you use to measure, like weight or price, and the capillary is the collection point, the place where the check is written. Let's start with the heart, the money, and looking at Washington State, you may say, well, taxes are too high at first because costs are high, and all the companies aren't up and running, so lack of supply makes the price high, so the black market can undercut the legal price, and the tax is so high that people don't pay it. So the state doesn't collect much. Now, maybe you can collect more later over time, and because the legal market can move out the learning curve and become more efficient, and the black market doesn't benefit from those economies. So a Massachusetts House bill now would phase up the tax rate over time, so starting with $10 an ounce and moving to $50 an ounce over a four-year period for flowers. The critical goal is to keep taxes low enough at first to beat the black market. Now that's the heart, and now the artery, which is the tax base. You tax by weight. If you wanted to shift to percentage of price, I would wave a huge red flag. That's my opinion. Because taxing by price makes taxes high when they should be low, and low when they should be high. Once the industry matures, a price-based tax can go haywire, because when prices go down, a price-based tax goes down automatically, and that means state revenue goes down. And not only that, low after-tax prices could irritate the federal government, especially in 2017, when who knows what will happen, and could irritate opponents of legalization like parents. There's another problem with taxing by price is that prices can be phony, like the $20 bong that comes with a free eighth of an ounce of marijuana. Prices are slippery. People can agree about how much a package weighs. Well, that's for the artery. Now it's what you're asking about, but it all fits together, and thanks for bearing with me. The capillary here is the collection point. It's natural that growers don't want to handle marijuana taxes for the state. Nobody does. And growers have several valid gripes about being the taxpayer. I've left some of those in my written statement on page 3. Well, why not have the retailer be the one who's responsible for doing the tax? And one answer is, and this comes from the lessons of alcohol and tobacco, is collect tax early. That if you collect late, a retail tax may not ever get collected. So in the case of a shoplifter or an employee who pilfers stuff off the shelf, or if the truck gets hijacked, your tax was collected early, well, it's collected. If it wasn't collected early, it's never collected.
Boy, he's stretching.
Now, early collection doesn't solve all problems. You still need tracking and tracing to prove chain of custody. And I understand the issue of that the growers would like to, I think, separate recreational, and they don't want to have to separate recreational and medical product at the grower level. And you can't. Let's say you wanted to tax at the retail level. Well, you can't really tax edibles very well at the retail level directly. You don't want to tax a wheat cookie more than a strong cookie, so weight at retail doesn't work for edibles. So if you're determined to shift the burden from growers, and nobody wants to be in the middle of this, I'm sure, you could throw up your hands and scrap the weight-based tax and bring in a price-based tax because you don't like the collection point. But that's the capillary in charge of the heart. It's like swapping out the dog you have because you don't like its tail. But let me brainstorm here with you and think about another option. That if you are determined to shift the burden from growers, something you might consider, and this is on page 5 of my testimony, is that you could bifurcate the tax base. You could tax at retail, and this would be a retail level tax, which I'm not a big fan of, but maybe it's the second best option. Tax plant matter by weight at retail. And then tax concentrates and products of concentrates by THC content. And the reason that might work is it looks like you can measure THC in concentrates accurately enough to be close enough for government work to put a tax on. And then follow it into products like edible, trace it. If you collect both, you could collect both taxes at retail. Now, this is a big departure from Measure 91, and I'm not endorsing it, but if you went that way, you keep the $35 an ounce, $10 an ounce for flowers and leaves, but you'd need to figure out a new tax on THC that kind of would correspond to the $10 per ounce tax of trim. That way, if you wanted to, you could exempt medical marijuana from tax at the retail level if that's what you want to do. I'm nervous about a retail collection point, which is the issue you've asked me about, but I think of that as a capillary issue, and I would sacrifice the early collection principle to protect the artery of the weight base and the heart of the state's revenue. So let me wrap up. We're in uncharted territory, and I have a lot to learn, but I thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I'll be happy to try to answer any questions.
Yes, Senator Burdick.
Thank you. I'm Junie Burdick, co-chair of this committee. You had mentioned kind of a bifurcated tax as an option. What would Would it be possible to have a tax system where you just tax THC? Excuse me. You can see I'm kind of new to this issue.
Chairs and Chair Burdick, here's the thinking on that. We don't tax, you can probably tax anything that goes through a liquid state because it's homogeneous enough. You put your eyedropper into the vat and pull it out, and everybody gets the same number. Everybody gets the same percentage, just like alcohol, which we tax liquor at the federal level by proof. So 50-proof liquor, 100-proof liquor gets taxed more than 80-proof liquor. For the plant matter, for the bud and the green plant matter, I don't think it's possible to get an answer that's close enough for government work. That is, we don't tax cigarettes by tar and nicotine because it's not reliable enough. Sampling, you're going to have folks who make a career. If you tried to do that, you'd have a lot of game playing. And, my sample said it was this, and but I got a sampler over there. It's kind of like a real estate appraiser. What number do you want?
I get that. And I do have a follow-up question. If you keep the tax at the grower level, how could you, if we decide not to tax medical marijuana, how could we pull off not taxing medical marijuana if we're doing this at the grower level without subjecting the growers? I mean, how could you pull that off at the retail level? Would you do a tax credit or file a rebate form, or how would you do that?
Chair Burnett and Co-Chair Leininger, that gets complicated. That if you impose your tax at the grower level, you would. Here's one way you could do it. The grower, when he ships the product out the door, would designate, this is medical and it will not bear tax. So I'm sending it into the supply chain untaxed, and it's dedicated and has to be tracked and traced as medical throughout its history. And then the rest of the product is designated as recreational, and I pay tax on that, and it carries with it the tax and has to be used in the recreational market. And that I can understand that folks say, well, wait a minute, I don't know what the market's going to, I don't know how to make that decision very, very well. I don't know what to irrevocably designate product as designated as for one market or another is a burden on the business sector.
Right.
If you do it in retail, then it's at the last minute. And so if you want an exemption for medical marijuana, then there could be a situation. I don't know what the plan is, but say there's a store that sells both to recreational customers and medical customers. And I don't know if that's the plan. But certainly one option is to say, okay, you walk in, if you collect at the retail level, customer walks in and either pays tax or doesn't. Is that responsive?
Thank you.
I see that Senator Przanski has a question.
Mr. Oglesby, this is Floyd Przanski. I wanted to just follow up on your concern about taxing at the point of sale retail. It sounded to me from your presentation, your major concern is that if you don't tax early, you have the potential of stuff being either siphoned off or somehow, and you said stolen or whatever, where the tax isn't imposed because it somehow doesn't make it to the point of where the tax would be collected?
Yes, sir. Madam Chair and Senator Przanski, That's correct. I mean, think of the hijacked truck case, that if you've collected tax early in the supply chain, say the grower puts product on a truck and the tax has been paid, and if somebody hijacks that truck, well, the state is not out the money. But if you're waiting for the retail sale for the tax to get collected, anytime anything gets siphoned out of the supply chain, then the tax has not been collected. Another shoplifting is another
just one
example.
So just as a follow-up, if you took the state, let's say the safeguards to, let's say, ensure that the product did actually make it to retail and it was actually collected there, there's not a strong concern on your part so long as you can maintain that system?
Madam Chair, Senator Przanski, it seems to me that you might well be able to come up with a system where somebody is responsible if the truck gets hijacked. That if, you know, and that if something, if inventory disappears from the shelf of the retailer, that tax gets collected kind of on a no-fault basis. Now, that people are not going to be, might not be happy about that, but that's the kind of backup system that a seed-to-sale tracking system might dovetail with.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you so much. You know, before we sign off, I just want to note one more thing that I have heard as a concern about point-of-sale taxation in this arena. You sort of alluded to it, Mr. Oglesby, is, you know, the idea of high cover charge, low per drink cost, right? You can really – there are ways to really reduce the amount of taxes paid. For example, a facility may charge an entrance fee, but then once you're inside the facility, it's really inexpensive. Or there may be a high delivery charge to get product, but the product itself is super cheap. You know, that is a way that it could be structured then that kind of beats the whole tax amount that has been worked through here. But, you know, there it's legitimate questions.
Madam Chair, that is not a problem, should not be a problem with a weight-based tax.
The weight-based tax.
Washington State probably has that because they're taxing by percentage. Yeah. But if it's weight, we don't care if the employee, you know, if you sell it to the employee for a discount.
Yes.
Madam Chair, I got to ask a question.
Yes. There's no relationship.
We have Representative Olson with a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hey, Pat, I'm curious. I mean, you're probably aware that we have, you know, the medical marijuana side of the program here in Oregon right now. And a few years ago, legislature increased the fee for the medical card holder. So in essence, that's somewhat kind of a built-in tax already for them. We're moving forward with what we're doing with the recreational side through Measure 91. What's your thoughts on doing away with the fee toward the medical side, mixing those two up? I'm just curious your thoughts.
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, the Colorado reduced its medical fee a while back, and they're having a tremendous problem with folks pretending to be sick who are getting in the medical program and not paying tax. And there are press accounts of this, and it's just, to some extent, it's a joke. And there's a quote by Pete Holmes, the city attorney of Seattle, who went to Colorado, and he said, "The people who are buying on the recreational market and not the medical market are chumps and tourists." So to ensure, I mean, you've got a problem. Is the medical system covering folks who are really sick, or is it covering folks who are clever also and willing to lie?
You can be both, sick and clever.
Right. Well, that was really a delightful phone call. We really appreciate your insight.
My pleasure. It's a thrill. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Are you letting me?
Oh, but one more thing, please.
Can I see you on the video screen here? I'm on the radio. So.
We have one last question from Senator Farioli, please.
Are you with us?
Yes, sir.
This is a question I think that's directed to your what I perceive to be pretty broad experience with many states entering this debate. The argument that we've been hearing is one of laxity versus stringency in the licensure. So arguing for laxity, we get everybody in the system, we combat bootlegging, we deprive the cartels of a supply by allowing regulatory authority, and those are arguments being made by people who would support the position of laxity for licensure. There's an argument for stringency, and that's that it essentially promotes public safety by preventing lawbreakers and others from entering the system, and it assures communities that some due diligence was done before people got a license. So in that regard,
What are the states doing? Are they licensing with laxity, or are they licensing with stringency, you know, as they get these things ramped up?
Madam Chair, Senator Farioli, I really, that's outside my area of expertise, and I wish I had a good answer, but I think there are folks more qualified. I'm a simple tax man.
All right, then. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee.
All right. And the two final speakers we have for tonight, thank you both for your patience and being here. I'm going to, in the vein that we've been in on tax amounts, I'm going to ask Mr. Whalen to describe your role in figuring out the amount of tax that is levied, and then I'm going to turn it over to Scott Winkles, who's been so patient with the League of Oregon Cities, to describe concerns that his clients have and opportunities they would like in terms of taxation. So please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Co-Chairs, committee members, my name is Robert Whalen. I'm a senior economist and director at Echo Northwest, been there for 20 years, specialize in business economics, mostly private sector work. And back about a year ago, I was asked by the petitioners of that ballot measure to look at the and try to estimate how much tax would the state collect. And I did basically an industrial analysis, building it up from scratch. It's very complicated work. And I'm representing basically myself and Echo Northwest today. I'm not a paid consultant by anybody in this business, and I can answer questions about that analysis, that tax analysis. But I wanted to do, and I sent out this one sheet thing, point out some of the things I ran across, and be aware, when I started this work, I was not a proponent. I actually told them I'm not even voting for your measure when I took this work, and they said that's fine, just give us the answer, and. Let me go over some of the things I ran across that, if I were in your position, I would consider or be concerned about. First thing is that the law says basically there'd be a $35 per ounce tax on marijuana flowers. And I asked them this. I said, what do you mean by marijuana flowers? Because I'm a science guy. And they said, well, we mean the buds. I said, but a bud isn't a flower. If you know marijuana buds, they're collections of all kinds of plant parts that aren't flowers. I said, maybe 5% of the weight of that bud is actually flower. Couldn't somebody just not pay tax? Because the tax only applies to leaves and flowers. And they said, well, no, we mean, in the industry term is flowers. I said, yeah, but the botanical term for a bud is a pistillate inflorescence. It's what it is. Go to Oregon State and ask a botanist, what is a bud? What is that actually called by law? So, well, there's little bits of flower in there, but most of it is bracts and calyxes and sepals and other parts of a plant that these guys didn't have. I would recommend that be something corrected right away. The other thing is there's no standard. $35 per ounce of exactly what? Okay, so we get the pistillate inflorescence. Okay, that's fine. But what's the standard for that? You know, when you sell wheat, if you're in Pendleton, you're selling, number two soft winter wheat, white wheat. There's an actual standard. It can't be over 10% protein. The moisture can't be over 13%. If I'm selling and having being taxed on an ounce of a marijuana plant, I'd be sure to dehydrate it to 1% moisture if I could get away with it in order to have to pay the least tax possible. There's no standard, so I would strongly recommend that some effort be made to get agriculture experts that set standards. There's commercial standards for different grades of wheat and barley and all kinds of agricultural crops. You're talking about legalizing an agricultural crop. Have somebody at Oregon State set us the standards for it in terms of contaminant levels.
Easy to measure.
Sort of how much water, mold, these types of things, and write it into rules. And be aware that the 10% tax on leaves, it says leaves, not trim, it says leaves, means that most leaves would just be composted. Nobody's going to pay that. I've been told by people that grow this stuff that the leaves are not worth $10 an ounce, let alone to be taxed $10 an ounce. The other thing, I'm going to bring this up because the tax guy brought this up, Co-Chair Burdick brought this up. I really think they should tax on THC level. Because what's going to happen is you're basically the consumer, most consumers, there are some that are into this as if it was fine wine, but the average consumer of this product wants high THC level. If they could buy pure THC, they would. So it's the THC level that matters, not the buds or any of that other stuff. And so what's going to happen is if you tax on ounce of product, people will try to grow the highest THC content possible. Heck, if there's no standard, they could have a bud and then separate THC from some other product and spray it on the buds and then pay a $35 tax on that, enhance the product, because there's no standard. I would consider taxing on THC level. I don't know sure why you can't. Again, I had to bring up weed again because I know the product well, but there's standards on it and measurement rules. Could be done. Another thing to remember is, obviously, everyone knows the more you tax the product, probably the more the black market will be sustained, which will become a gray market. It'll be like when the lottery legalized sports betting. They stopped arresting bookmakers in the state. I think there's been one person convicted of bookmaking in the last 5 years because the lottery has sports betting or had sports betting. When you legalize this stuff for some people to sell and grow, the black market is going to be less enforced, less threatened, I think. And it's going to be more difficult to get convictions of people. And so if you have a high tax, a very high tax, which you don't, at $35 is pretty low, you'll have a situation like you do in Washington where the retailers can't compete with the black market, which is really now a gray market. The gray market dealers stand outside in the parking lots of the retail stores and sell to people walking in. This is going to happen, but the cost isn't just going to be the tax, it's going to be the level of regulation. If it's regulated, you know, seed to store and watched at every step, it's going to be so expensive by the time it gets sold. One of the problems they have in Colorado and Washington is the level of regulation, the cost of regulation is so over the top that the free market doesn't work. And the product is so expensive at the retail level that the black market just thrives, and it continues to thrive. So most of the sales in Colorado are to tourists. It's had very little effect in cutting into sales in the black market in Washington state. Another thing always concerned me, I talked to it. There's a sociology professor at Oregon State, Seth Crawford, who really knows this industry as it exists now. This isn't a new industry you're creating. And he really had some very interesting tools for measuring what was going on. And he said to me that, you know, Oregon's a major exporter now, has been for years. And I checked this out with somebody else who worked for the DEA. He said, oh, yeah, most of the pot sold in Connecticut comes from Oregon. We are a major exporter, so you want to make sure that whatever system you have for watching growers, you make sure that they're growers for the in-state market only, and that there be severe consequences if they do anything other than that. And then finally, the last thing is an area where cities may want to tax or the state may want to tax are all in the supplementary industries related to marijuana that will pop up. There's going to be a lot of them. Down to suppliers tourism industries and things like that that will crop up, and that's something to consider too. It's amazing what can happen in the state.
Well, thank you for that. I'm going to ask Mr. Wingles to give his presentation, and if there are a few minutes at the end that we can stay, great. But thank you both so much for your patience and your presence.
Madam Co-Chair, as members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Wingles, and I represent the League of Oregon Cities. I'm going to talk about the local tax issue, and to do that, I do need to run briefly through the current distribution formula and why we think the local, which explain sort of gets at why we think the local taxes are important. Under the current, the way Measure 91 was passed, in the first year, there will be a population-based distribution of revenue. In the second year, the distribution will be based on the number of licenses that are going to be in that jurisdiction. I think we need to talk about how much money cities can expect to receive. I'm looking at the Legislative Revenue Office estimates. I'm not sure if this is the most recent. My understanding is the costs may have gone. They may have increased the amount they're looking at for implementation. But in the first year, it looks like cities are expected to receive $938,000 split statewide in marijuana revenue in the first year. Going into the second year and the 17-19 biennium, statewide cities could be expected to split $2 million a year with a roughly $4 million for the biennium. We have concerns with this. On top of now the aforementioned scourge of truck hijackings we can expect, we have looked at cities in Washington. We have looked at their experience. If we look at the city of, say, Kirkland, Washington, where the citizens passed their legalization measure by a fairly healthy margin, their pushback from the citizenry has prevented any retail locations from opening, last I checked, which was last week. They're getting a lot of concerns from citizens. People who ostensibly voted for the measure were also showing up at the city council with maps of where, how kids were walking to school, studies on how it would impact quality of urban life. This is what local governments can expect. I think what I would really like to impress upon this committee is that the impacts of legalization are going to be felt more acutely at the local level than they are at the state level. Complaints are going to go to your city manager. They're going to go to your code enforcement officer. They're going to go to your police department. Smoke drifting into your cities, into your neighbor's yard, from your kids inhaling it, that's a complaint that's going to be fielded by the city government. And it looks like a statewide share of $4 million biennium is what cities will have to cope with the financial expenses. About 70 cities, I don't call an exhaustive list because I don't know that every city that did this notified the league, have enacted a local tax of some sort. The vast majority of those are at around 10%. I think there might be a handful at 15. There's the outlier of Fairview at 40. If a city has limited local taxation authority, with all due respect, a pittance from the state in shared revenue for the expenditure and a difficult regulatory regime in order for the city to address local concerns, I think it's logical to expect that some cities are going to avail themselves to the options Mr. Bovet lined out. However, I think there's a better way. I think if we can allow some local flexibility on taxation and regulation, we can get to that DAO, that path of least resistance, that allows the cities to sort of navigate this, let them be financially whole, and craft a regulatory regime that's going to meet their local needs. And I think you'll get more acceptance of retail if we take a more flexible hand with local governments. With that, looking at the clock, I will conclude my testimony.
Do we have any questions for this panel, colleagues?
Mr. Wingles?
Yes, sir.
So you heard Mr. Bovet's testimony. You referred to it. Do you concur, or does your attorney, that cities can opt out by ordinance?
Co-Chair Leninger and Co-Chair Burdick, Senator Ferrioli. Yes, we think they can, and our attorneys have identified some other legal theories that were not covered in Mr. Bovet's testimony.
So you also heard the paradox of very tight regulation could be an open invitation to the bootlegger to come to a neighborhood near you. So then opt-out creates a market. That market probably will get served.
Yes.
Thank you, Chair.
Any other questions, comments, closing thoughts for the evening? All right, then I'm going to close this informational hearing. Thank you to everyone who was a witness tonight. And then before we adjourn...
and processing.
Do we do them or talk about them?
It's up to you, Senator Cruz, and you can deal with the consequences. Senator Cruz, and you can deal with the consequences.